Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 3, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on censoring specialty license plates. My name is Christian Corrigan, and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome back a Federal Society regular, Professor Eugene Volokh from UCLA School of Law, who is the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law there. A more complete bio of our speaker was provided in notice of the call, so I'll just stop there and preserve more time for his presentation. And then, of course, afterwards, we'll take your questions. So, Professor Volokh, the floor is yours. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be on these. So when I was growing up in Los Angeles, we had one kind of license plate, the old blue background with the yellow letters, said California, and then your tag number. At some point around then, the state realized that it could make some money. It could make some money by allowing vanity plates. I could get a plate if I wanted to, saying Eugene. Well, unless some other Eugene had taken it before. So that was fun. And then many states concluded that there are other ways of making money through license plates as well. And one of them was the chief alternative to the vanity plates was the specialty plates, where not just the tag number, but the background could be designed, not by a particular individual, but by a group. So a group, they could be UCLA Bruins fans, I suppose, although California doesn't allow it, but other states do. They could design a particular UCLA plate, or UCLA itself could do that. USC could do the same, even though it's a private university. And then essentially the state would get a chunk of the extra fees that people would have to pay for the specialty plate, and then the group would get a chunk of the extra fees. So it seems like it's win-win-win. State makes money, group makes money, and people get to show off their individuality as members of a large group on their license plates. And that all went well until, of course, the foreseeable result that some people started selecting license plate designs, some groups started selecting license plate designs that others found offensive. And this has spawned a substantial amount of litigation. Some of that litigation is now before the U.S. Supreme Court in the Sons of Confederate Veterans license plate case, where state of Texas refused to allow a Sons of Confederate Veterans plate, even though it allowed lots of other license plate designs. And the Fifth Circuit said that was unconstitutionally viewpoint-based, and it's now before the Supreme Court to consider whether the viewpoint neutrality rule applies to those license plates. In New York, this bubbled up because of a Choose Life license plate. A pro-life group put together a Choose Life license plate. I'm looking at a copy. It says Choose Life in kind of a childish script at the bottom, and then has a picture of two, or very roughly drawn picture of two smiling children. It doesn't specifically mention abortion, but obviously people who see Choose Life will recognize it as a slogan associated with opposition to abortion. New York regulations prohibit, so quote, patently offensive, close quote, license plates. The Department of Motor Vehicles, to its credit, didn't just say, well, we think opposition to abortion is patently offensive. Support of abortion, just fine, but opposition is patently offensive. No, it said that patently offensive, we'll interpret it as prohibiting any politically sensitive and emotionally charged issues, I'm quoting there, regardless of the particular viewpoint espoused. So the DMV was saying, look, we don't want these license plate designs that are essentially political in a controversial way, or controversial in a political way. And that's why we reject this plate. And then the panel, the Second Circuit panel, upheld that by a 2-to-1 vote. The trouble, and one reason the dissenter dissented, is that it's not like New York had indeed consistently refused to allow any politically sensitive issues. For example, DMV at one point allowed a union yes plate, also allowed a plate that says support police. And in context, it was a plate to support an organization that helped helped investigate shootings of police officers. So that doesn't sound like the state is administering this in an even-handed way. Somehow it seems that controversial commentary on the subject of abortion, that's not allowed, whereas controversial commentary subject of unions and police officers is. Ah, says the majority, but that's not really that controversial. Not much controversy about unions, not much controversy about supporting police. Well, that's pretty controversial conclusion on its own, and it highlights the vagueness of these kinds of rules. What constitutes a politically sensitive and emotionally charged issue is going to be something that the government is will have to make judgment calls about, and judgment calls that may very well be influenced by the politics either of government officials or their view of the politics of the majority of the public. So that's the nature of this particular controversy. But there's a much bigger picture here. So first, the state argued, and the state of Texas is arguing in the Sons of Confederate Veterans case as well, that this isn't just normal speech by people, even normal speech using government property. This is, in a sense, government speech. After all, it's the government that issues these license plates, and the government should have authority to decide what it prints on its own plates. Generally speaking, circuit courts have rejected this view. This is not the view that the Second Circuit took in this case. The Second Circuit concluded that this program is a so-called non-public forum. That's a place where private speech is allowed, even though the government hasn't deliberately opened it up for a wide range of private speech. And that because it's a non-public forum rather than being government speech, viewpoint neutrality is indeed required. It's just the Second Circuit concluded that viewpoint neutrality is satisfied here. Despite the anomalies, the inconsistencies, at least in my view, that I just mentioned. A second point that I think we have to acknowledge here is, on its own, this is a case about very little. And that's because right next to that license plate that somebody so proudly displays, there's a bumper. And on that bumper, somebody could put whatever bumper stickers he wants. He can put on more. They can be larger. They can be more visible. They can contain anything he wants them to contain. And the state does not purport to control what people put up on their bumper sticker. If you want to put up a patently offensive bumper sticker, you're perfectly free to do that. So really, this particular decision on the state's part, even if we conclude it is viewpoint discriminatory, doesn't materially interfere with people's ability to communicate their message. Again, they can't communicate it on this specialty license plate, but they can communicate it right next to it in a much more effective way. The reason this case is important, the reason the Sons of Confederate Veterans case before the Supreme Court is important, is that this category of programs, things that are sometimes called non-public forums, programs where the government makes it possible for people to speak in certain ways with certain government-provided benefits, but deliberately doesn't open it up for all speech by everybody. These programs are very common, and they're very important and much more practically important than just this license plate program. For example, consider the charitable tax deduction, the one that allows you to donate money to the Federalist Society, which I highly encourage you to do, and allows you to take a tax deduction for that donation. The court has recognized, and I think correctly, that this kind of charitable tax deduction is essentially economically tantamount to a form of subsidy, that it's essentially as if the government were paying a matching grant every time somebody gives a charitable tax exemption. This is a subsidy that's not open to all speakers. For example, it specifically excludes contributions for election-related speech or for us to go to substantial degree to lobbying for the support or defeat of legislation. Still, it's open to a wide range of speech, and it's generally believed, and the Supreme Court has in fact specifically said, that because this is a program that's open to a wide range of, to support a wide range of speech, it has to be viewpoint neutral. They can't say, well, you can donate money to and get this tax exemption for all causes, but not anti-abortion causes, but or not anti-war causes, or not pro-gun causes. That would be unconstitutional because in these kinds of programs, even though they involve a government subsidy, even though they involve interaction between the government and private parties, there still has to be viewpoint neutrality. Once that viewpoint neutrality requirement is relaxed, either by being just facially eliminated as certain kinds of programs, or by being applied in a way that is not really sound, will go far beyond these particular kinds of programs like the license plate programs, where, as I mentioned, really not that much is at stake. It'll go to restrictions on student groups and funding for student groups and student newspapers on public university campuses. It will potentially apply, as I mentioned, to the charitable tax exemption. It potentially will apply to things like federal grants for students. What is it that keeps the federal government from saying if you want a student loan or if you want a student grant, you can't use it at a university which we think teaches bad ideas about race or religion or whatever else? Well, it's the viewpoint neutrality requirement that is applicable even to various government benefit or government subsidy programs, or programs where it's not just private speech but private speech that interacts with the government. That they get certain kinds of preferred treatment from the government. Generally speaking, the government has to be viewpoint neutral there. To be sure, if the government is indeed consciously trying to express its own views, for example, if it subsidizes the National Endowment for Democracy, it doesn't have to viewpoint neutrally subsidize the National Endowment for Communism or the National Endowment for Dictatorship. Once you get outside the government selecting particular messages of its own to promote and get to the government opening up a place where people can express their own views, there viewpoint neutrality is generally required, and decisions such as the Second Circuit one in this Choose Life license plate case, I think, undermine that viewpoint neutrality. This was a 2-1 decision. Presumably there will be a petition for a hearing en banc by the Second Circuit, so it's possible, though not terribly likely, that that'll go there. It's also likely that there will be a petition for certiorari, so asking the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case. I'm not sure the U.S. Supreme Court will be interested in hearing the case in full, but it's certainly possible that once the Sons of Confederate Veterans decision is indeed handed down, that'll happen within the month. If it's a decision that takes a generally pro-speaker position, the court might grant the petition for certiorari, vacate the Second Circuit decision, and remand for further consideration in light of the new language in Sons of Confederate Veterans. So it'll be interesting to monitor this case as it goes forward. I was asked to also talk about another case involving government-provided forum or non-public forum for speech. And that is this decision by the Washington Transportation Agency, Washington, D.C. Transportation Agency, to stop taking any issue-oriented, that is to say, as opposed to commercial advertising, so any non-commercial advertising advertisements for its buses and subways. And the reason it did that is because the American Freedom Defense Initiative, which is certainly can be described as an anti-extremist Muslim group, but I think it is fairly, let's say anti-extremist Islam group, I think fairly can be said to be a group that is quite skeptical of Islam generally, wanted to put up an ad on Washington, D.C. buses with a cartoon, I think actually quite effectively made cartoon, depicting Muhammad. And I'm looking at the cartoon here. It's a picture of Muhammad with a sword and a mouth bubble saying, "You can't draw me." And then there is a hand with a pencil, so obviously depicting the cartoonist himself, drawing him, and the mouth bubble says, "That's why I draw you." So this is a gesture of defiance, of demands that Muhammad not be drawn. Up until this ad was submitted, Washington Transportation Agency, likewise seeking to make money, opened up its various spaces on buses and on the metro to a wide range of advertising. You could have a commercial advertisement, you could have a political advertisement, you could have, let's say, advertisement, a wide range of public policy issues. But it was this cartoon or this proposed ad that caused it to change its policy. And there's a quote, kind of a very telling, although unpleasant quote, from somebody who had served. He was not now the chairman of the Metro Systems Board of. He's not now the chairman of the Metro Systems Board of Directors, but had twice been its chairman, and for 12 years had been a member. The quote is: "We know what happens when you criticize Muhammad. We know how some people react to that, and because they didn't want that reaction, which is to say a violent reaction, possible vandalism or much worse, of buses and subways, they decided to stop allowing any kind of issue ads, because they are aware of this of the requirement of viewpoint neutrality." And they thought that it wasn't a good idea to say, "Well, we'll allow issue ads, but not this one." Instead, they said commercial advertising only. Now, back in 1974, the Supreme Court had said that if a city transportation agency decides that it doesn't want to allow anything except commercial advertising, if it allows only commercial advertising and not advertising for political candidates or other causes, it's free to do that. That's a content-based restriction, but again, it's a viewpoint-neutral restriction. All issues are all issue advertising is forbidden. Only commercial advertising is allowed, and because it's the government controlling what is said on its own property, again, the requirement is simply one of reasonableness and viewpoint neutrality. So I do think that it's constitutional for a city to have this kind of policy, commercial advertising only. Now, some people have questioned whether it's constitutional for it to create such a policy precisely because of a position precisely because it didn't want to include this highly controversial issue ad. And the answer, I think, is yes, that's fine. While it's true, Supreme Court has said that a policy can be unconstitutionally viewpoint-based if the motivation for it is hostility to a particular viewpoint. The court has also said that a motivation for a policy is simply a desire to avoid things that are unduly controversial. Then the government can indeed institute a viewpoint-neutral policy. Now, a policy that says no controversial speech, that would probably be unconstitutional, partly because it's vague and partly because what is and is not controversial often does turn on viewpoint. But if there's a facially viewpoint-neutral policy, such as no commercial advertising, or in a case called Cornelius v. NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, funding only of organizations that provide direct services to people rather than engage in litigation, let's say, that kind of viewpoint-neutral policy can be adopted if its motivation is to minimize controversy and to focus on the less controversial of possible speakers. So I think that that it's constitutional for Washington to do what it's doing. I just think it's actually quite dangerous. And it's dangerous to free speech, and I think it's dangerous to public safety more broadly. Basically, what we're seeing in a lot of these decisions is that thuggery works, that the message that is coming out is if you make enough threats, if you threaten violence against certain kinds of speakers, then we will indeed shut up those speakers. Now, to be sure, that's worst of all if the government is coercively shutting them up, even on private property or in a traditional public forum, such as on a sidewalk or in a park. There's a case about that very so-called heckler's veto issue now pending before the Sixth Circuit and Bank Court. The case is called Bible Believers, and it involved also anti-Islam speech there at an Arab festival in Michigan. But even when we're talking about speech on government property, other than a traditional public forum, so government property such as advertising in a bus, or such as speech in a government building, or something along those lines, once the government says, "Hey, you know, people have been making threats, we're going to shut it down," what's it doing? It's creating an incentive to make more such threats, and sometimes to make good on those threats in order to make the threats credible. So what will happen is those who are willing to use violence, willing to threaten violence, will see that it pays. Behavior that is rewarded is repeated. So we're likely to see, both from the extremist Muslim wing, more threats against this kind of speech. But what's more, this is a message that thugs on all sides of the spectrum are going to learn. There was a case, for example, in Seattle, where Seattle refused to allow a particular harshly anti-Israel ad because it had gotten anonymous emails saying, if I see this harshly anti-Israel ad on a bus, I might go and attack the bus. I might vandalize it. I might bomb it, or something along those lines. And of course, it's not difficult to send an anonymous email in a way that's hard to trace. So this is actually cheap thuggery, but it pays. It pays. And again, behavior that's rewarded is repeated. If people learn that in order to shut up speech that they don't want, that they don't like, they just need to threaten the speakers and sometimes attack the speakers, that's what they're going to be doing more and more. So I do think the Washington decision to go back to the less controversial commercial advertisements is constitutionally permissible. I don't think it's good for public debate more broadly. I don't think it's good for security more broadly. So with that, I think I'm done, and I hope there are lots of questions from you folks.
All right. Well, we have over 50 callers on the line, so let's see if any of them have questions for you. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Volokh, enter star and then the pound key. I want to do one quick programming note about our next scheduled Teleform conference call, which is tomorrow at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. It features Professors Ilya Soman and Richard Epstein on The Grasping Hand, Kelo versus City of New London, the 10-year anniversary, and the limits of eminent domain. Excuse me. And that will be tomorrow, Thursday, June 4th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. So again, if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Volokh, press star and then the pound key. Our lines are open. And I guess one other in-person programming note, for those of you in the Washington, D.C. area, on Thursday, June 18th, we will be hosting our third annual Executive Branch Review Conference here in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel. More information is available on our website at fedsoc.org. Well, Professor Volokh, we have it's a captive audience, but it is also a quiet audience today. We've got plenty of callers, but they seem a little quiet or without questions at the moment. So if you have a question or comment for Professor Volokh, press star and then the pound key now. Oh, looks like we do have our first question on the line.
Yes, Professor. It's David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. My question has to do with whether or not you see any similarities as to what's going on here with another case which is making its way through the courts having to do with the Washington Redskins trademark and the cancellation of that mark due to the fact that it was disparaging, contemptuous, or disreputable as a form of commercial speech, and any kind of overlap between the issues implicated there and the cases that you've been mentioning.
I'm very glad you mentioned this, because I do think that there's a great deal of overlap between this especially and the Choose Life case. And again, it highlights the importance of this non-public forum doctrine and the requirement of viewpoint neutrality. So the Redskins trademark case is not about whether the Redskins are free to use the name Redskins. Even if their trademark is canceled, they can call themselves whatever they want, including the Redskins. The trademark law will not stop them. But what trademark law will do is it will diminish their ability to block infringing merchandise. So it will dry up, cancellation of the trademark will dry up in some measure, I shouldn't say dry up, but let's say reduce in considerable measure one important source of revenue for the Redskins. So one way of thinking about, and I think a correct way of thinking about trademark law, by the way, the same thing applies to copyright law, is that it too is a kind of subsidy for a kind of benefit provided by the government for certain kinds of speech. Just as the tax exemption is a benefit for contributions to charitable organizations, including speaking organizations, just as the license plate programs are a government-provided place, the government doesn't have to provide it, but it could if it wants to, provided place for people to be able to express themselves. If the government has the ability to discriminate based on viewpoint in issuing these kinds of benefits, then it could do a great deal in order to influence influence kind of the shape of public discourse, the shape of what is said out there. That's in fact the very reason that foes of the name Redskins are trying to cancel the trademark. They're not thinking, oh, well, yes, indeed, we are big believers in freedom of putting out unauthorized merchandise, and we're in it because we want more and more unauthorized Redskins merchandise produced without the risk of trademark infringement lawsuits. Rather, they're hoping, their goal is that if the trademark is canceled, the Redskins will be deterred from calling themselves the Redskins. Maybe the Indians will be deterred from calling themselves Indians or using particular images. Likewise with other teams. And of course, if that's allowed, then you could imagine the government in the future likewise using trademark limitations on trademark as a leverage to discourage certain other kinds of names for teams, for organizations, and the like. And this isn't limited to trademark. Think about copyright. Already there's some talk about trying to deter the production of pornography by stripping pornography of copyright protection. I actually think for complicated reasons that would have the exact that would actually make pornography more broadly available, and won't do much to dry up the amount of pornography out there. Whether or not one thinks that's a good thing. But setting that aside, it's possible that in fact, I think it's likely that a viewpoint-neutral restriction along those lines would be constitutional, in part because the government doesn't have to provide copyright protection. It can say, well, for certain subject matters, broad subject matters, we think that we don't want to provide an incentive to industry and art in this particular area. But imagine that the viewpoint neutrality requirement is absent. The government could say, you know, we're not going to provide copyright protection to movies that we think portray racial and religious groups in derogatory ways. So as a result, if you make a particular kind of movie, then in that case, people will be perfectly free to copy it. Your investors will figure that out, and your investors therefore won't invest in the movie. That would have a huge effect on on the public debate in the marketplace of ideas. The government will not have outright restricted any speech. In fact, it would have said, hey, speech is even freer than before, in a sense, in that anybody who wants to speak using this movie, to reproduce this movie, is free to do that without the constraints of copyright law. But because the government would be using the incentives, the benefits provided by copyright law in a viewpoint-based way, it will have, would end up having very broad power to control public debate. Interesting, the trademark issue is now before the Federal Circuit, the circuit court that is in charge of a lot of trademark issues, not in the Redskins case, but in the Slants case. The case is called In Re Tam. There is an Asian American band called the Slants, and their view is Slants is somewhat unusual, pejorative, I think, for Asian Americans these days, but still it's one that they want to kind of reclaim as a positive thing for themselves. But their but the trademark office said, well, that is a derogatory term. We're not going to register it. Just like sometime earlier, the trademark office said the same as to the proposed trademark for Stop the Islamization of America. Another, I think, American Freedom Defense Initiative project for criticizing what they see as undue spread of Islam. So the Federal Circuit is going to be now reconsidering these things and asking whether indeed this statutory provision, it is a statutory provision, by the way, it's not somehow the courts or the PTO's fault. It's Congress that a long time ago in the Lanham Act barred these kinds of derogatory trademarks, or rather trademarks that the PTO concludes are derogatory, because there's often a lot of controversy about that. So the Federal Circuit is going to be considering whether this statutory limitation on trademarks is indeed unconstitutional, in fact violates the First Amendment. That'll be an interesting case to watch.
All right. Well, our lines are open, so if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Volokh right now, press star and then the pound key.
Let me just say, by the way, it's interesting, if you look at the not quite politics, but let's say at the ideological valence of some of these debates, these days it's often conservatives who are speaking out against what they see as unconstitutional viewpoint discrimination in government, various government-provided benefit programs. This is a flip from the way things were up until, let's say, the early 1990s. Historically, it had been Justice Rehnquist, mostly Associate Justice, although later on in his years as Chief, who was the strongest advocate on the court of the view of that when the government is providing benefits, it can attach whatever strings it wants to them, at least, if not quite whatever, at least a very wide range of such strings. And it was generally the liberals in the court, Justices Brennan and Marshall in particular, who took the view that that once the government does open up a particular program, it has to treat people even-handedly. They, for example, dissented from that 1974 case involving the buses and the policy of commercial advertising only on the buses. They said that once the city allows advertising on buses, it has to allow it in a content-neutral, not just viewpoint-neutral, but a content-neutral way to include political advertising, include extremely controversial advertising. So that's what the pattern used to be on the court. And even today on the court, there conservatives, I think, have come around in some measure to the Brennan and Marshall view on the subject. But even so, Justices Scalia and Thomas take a relatively narrow view of that. They would say in a lot of areas, the government ought to have pretty broad authority to say, hey, you know, you want this benefit, you have to agree not to say certain things, you have to agree to say certain things. If you're a government contractor and you say certain things the government doesn't like, the government should be entitled to cancel the contract with you and such. they do think that certain kinds of programs should be treated as so-called limited public fora or designated public fora where viewpoint neutrality at least is required, but they take a relatively narrow view of that, and it's mostly the liberals in the court that have taken a generally broader view of that, except, interestingly, in the Christian Legal Society versus Martinez case, which involved restrictions on expressive association by public university-funded student groups where the views largely flipped. Historically, many, I think, of the old stalwarts of the Federalist Society, all the people most respected by the Federalist Society, would have at one point said, look, hey, once the government distributes money, it's entitled to attach whatever conditions the democratic process arrives at. In fact, if you look at original meaning, it's hard to tell what the framers would have thought, but certainly up through the early 1900s, even as the court was developing something of a more protective free speech jurisprudence, there was the view that, hey, once we're talking about government employees, government property, government programs, the government has basically unlimited authority. The reason that I think the more modern view, the view that used to be the liberal view and now I think is broadly agreed to, at least on the Supreme Court, is probably correct, is in the framing era, we had a very small government. And throughout much of American history, we had very small governments, both at the federal and state levels. When you've got a very small governments that engage in very particular and limited funding programs, then in that case, it's perfectly sensible to say that once they are spending their money, to be sure it's the taxpayers' money, but still money that the taxpayers have allotted to the government, the government can restrict that spending or restrict other benefits in a wide range of ways. Because, look, there's still all of this private money and private speech out there that's going to be completely unaffected by whatever government restrictions there are. Once you get the government taxing and then spending probably at the federal, state, and local level about 25% to 30% of the national GNP, once you get the government attaching conditions to a wide range of programs, through the tax system, through various kinds of subsidies, once you get the government essentially having become a necessary partner, virtually every charity out there through the charitable tax deduction, virtually every university out there, of this wide range of creators and businesses that want to express their views through their trademarks, then in that case, saying, hey, it's the government's discretion, government's free to impose these restrictions, that I think becomes unrealistic. Unrealistic if you want to preserve the vibrant marketplace of ideas that the framers were indeed trying to preserve, that I think at this point requires some constraints and these government imposed restrictions within government run programs.
All right. Well, we still have a couple minutes left, so let's do a last call for questions here. If you've, we still have a number of callers on the line, so if you'd like to ask a question of Professor Volokh about any of the topics he's covered today, press star and then the pound key. Again, one more reminder for those of you on the call that tomorrow's next scheduled Teleforum conference call is Thursday, June 4th at 12 p.m., featuring Professors Ilya Soman and Richard Epstein on the future of eminent domain, now that we're at the 10-year anniversary of Kelo versus City of New London. Well, Professor Volokh, since we don't seem to have any more questions, I want to give you an opportunity. If you have any final thoughts, anything else you want to cover, feel free to do that now. Otherwise, we can wrap up the call.
You know, I think we've talked enough. I've talked enough. I just wanted to thank the Federalist Society for making these kinds of programs possible.
Great. Well, for those of you on the call, as always, we're recording this call and we'll post it on our website. So if you'd like to re-listen to any of Professor Volokh's presentation, you can stream or download on our website at fedsoc.org. Again, check our website for an updated list of all of our newly scheduled Teleforum conference calls, which are updated and scheduled daily. So on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Professor Volokh for joining us once again. His perspective is always valuable on these issues. Also, on behalf of the Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, I'd like to thank you as well. Thank you to our audience. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. And don't forget to join us at our 30th Annual Executive Branch Review Conference on June 18th. Until next time, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.